This is Psychobabble, where we explore modern psychology and the newest research available. We explore the gems we find through everyday experiences, books, and movies. My name is Henry. I'm a biologist.
And my name's Tim. I'm a doctor.
And we both love psychology. Today's topic is absolute thinking. We'll start with a new piece of research about absolute language and its relation to mental health, and then move on to discuss absolute thinking and language more broadly. Finally, we'll use Gattaca, the 1997 dystopian sci-fi cult classic, as an analogy for a life based on absolutist thought. So, what is absolutist thinking?
Well, I'm glad that you asked, Henry. So, absolute thinking is one of the many cognitive distortions that exists. You might be asking, what are cognitive distortions? Something we're going to be talking a lot about. They're basically negative thinking habits that trick you into believing things that are simply not true and often lead to you becoming miserable. Absolute thinking specifically refers to the use of absolute words like, I never win, or I have always failed. I have wasted my whole life. Everything is pointless, etc., etc. The good thing about them is that they're quite easy to spot and debunk if you know what to look for. Today, we'll be discussing them and what you can do about them. So why are we talking about it? We're talking about this today because there's some research that's come out recently. It's published in January, so last month, this year, which talks about the use of absolutist words absolutist words on forum posts throughout the internet being markers for anxiety, depression, and ultimately suicidal ideation in some cases. Now, what they've shown, I mean, as we've discussed, absolute thinking, absolute words are part and parcel the cognitive distortion package. And they're one of, as we said at the beginning, one of the most common. And what we found, what we thought, was, you know, in Gattaca, had this incredibly rigid, you know, absolutist kind of world where everything is set in stone and will always be a certain way and you'll never amount to anything. It very much goes, you know, in line with this topic. So, you know, just to go over the research quickly, what they've basically shown is that there is a significant difference in absolutist words used by those writing on anxiety and depression and suicidal ideation forums compared to control forums that weren't specific for those groups of people. They also then showed, you know, further, you know, within those samples that the suicidal ideation groups used even more absolutist words than the anxiety and depression forums. So,
let me get this correct. Sorry, Tim.
That's fine.
If we're looking at a forum that's just standard, then the people that we see on there and all the things that they write will have a certain number of absolutist words. And then when we look at anxiety and depression forums, we'll find a lot more of those absolutist words, right?
That's 100% correct, yeah. So, yeah.
When we look at suicidal ideation forums, there'll be even more of these absolutist words that we find in the
exactly.
text that they submit.
Exactly. And so when we say significant, what we mean is that through statistics, so they've tested the amounts of words and, you know, through these tests that we can do, which are generally accepted by scientific communities, we can see that it's not just by chance. You know, you could test two groups of people and they could be using these words just by chance a little bit more, and it wouldn't necessarily tell you anything predictably about another population of people in the, whether they would use more or less of those words.
So what we can do is we can test these samples, as you very rightly said, to show that it's significant that these people are using a lot more words, and that is basically suggestive of something that is good evidence, is a good indicator.
So the implications are that we could look at what people are writing, not just in these forums, but elsewhere, and then compare it to the amount of absolutist words that are present in there. And if the absolutist words are present to a greater degree than you would find in just standard writing, in, as we've seen in the control group, in just normal forums, then we could say with a certain amount of confidence, this person may well be suffering from anxiety or depression, or at worst, suicide.
Yeah, I mean, it makes you think about something like Facebook, doesn't it? I mean, you wonder whether Facebook already does use algorithms to pick these things up. You know, there's a lot of talk about these suicides that get published on Facebook, right? And you think, well, do they already know? Can they highlight these people that are at risk? Based on the kind of language they're using, you know, obviously some more explicit than others. Some people might be writing to their peers, like their friends and family, you know, oh, I feel really bad. I want to hurt myself. You know, that's a relatively easy search to do, I guess. We kind of, what we'd want is to be able to get at those people and help them before that stage, right?
Right.
So,
yes, of course, because it could be very bad when they're already making it very explicit. But what about all of the time before that, when it wasn't so explicit, but still there, lingering and expressing itself in more subtle ways, right? It would be nice if we could reach these people earlier.
Exactly. And so what we've seen, well, at least what they've seen in the research, is that the use of absolutist words is actually a very good indicator, better indicator than just saying, oh, I feel sad or I feel bad, of depression and anxiety, because it reflects this language that these people are using, this absolutist language, as we said before, which includes words like absolutely, always, completely, every, never, nothing, totally. These kind of words which really limit, the words themselves are actually, they're limited, but they're actually kind of very expansive, but they limit the individual. It's an interesting kind of duality, I guess.
Right, yes, they limit because they overgeneralize, right?
Yeah, exactly. But what we've seen is that those words are more predictive of mental illness than words like I said, like feel sad, I feel bad, I feel low, those kind of things that, people might say, but then again, not necessarily mean you're depressed or you're anxious. Everyone can feel low, everyone can feel sad. The last thing that the research, that we're talking about this week shows is that it's not just that people who are depressed or anxious can, use these words. It's actually possibly that people who use this kind of language, and possibly, this alludes to an absolute thinking style. So someone who thinks, oh, I'm never going to win, I'm never going to be good at this, who limits themselves in that way, might be predisposed, which means prone to or vulnerable or susceptible to becoming depressed or anxious, or, at the most extreme, committing suicide. Obviously, I'm sure you'll agree. If you were to say to yourself, "Oh, I'll never mount to anything," that's a pretty damning thing to say to yourself.
Right. Yeah. Not only is it wrong in that I can't tell the future, and there's no telling what I could do. If I put my mind to it. It's also damning in the way that you said, because I could make it a reality if I continue thinking like that.
Exactly.
you miss every single, sorry, you, there's a great idiom that I just slipped my mind. It goes along the lines of, yeah, you miss every single swing or shot that you don't take.
Exactly.
It's no wonder that you end up losing.
Exactly.
It's almost like a chicken and egg dilemma, because do you have those thoughts simply because something went wrong in your life, you know, biologically as well as mentally, or was it a bit more of a gray region, and these thoughts, they build up and egg each other on, right? It drives you down a worse path.
A dark path, exactly, which is probably why you have this susceptibility. I mean, or at least why it becomes exaggerated in those states. And it's a bit like you said, a chicken and egg, you know, did you start with it and then it kind of made you feel worse? And then in making you feel worse, you kind of used more language like that. And then it kind of exponentially gets worse as you become more and more absolute in your thinking and become more and more depressed and, you know, with of a low mood.
Yeah, isn't it strange? Because as a self-fulfilling prophecy, every time it turns out to be correct, you're reinforcing the idea that your worldview is corresponding to reality, right?
And
every time you think these thoughts and reinforce it, strengthens the thought pattern in your brain, right?
Exactly. You know, because that's how it works. It's just like learning anything. You know, where anything that you learn, we all know that. You know, if you practice the lyrics of a song, you'll get better at them over time. And practicing the lyrics to your own song, to your life song, you know, the lyrics to your life, if you want to look at them that way, you know, the words that you use every day about yourself and to other people, about your achievements, you'll get better at that too. So yeah, it is a scary thought. It is a scary thought, and I think it really, what it hammers home at is the principle of the power of language, and its place in, or the power it has, and its place in good mental health, good positive language in good mental health, in reinforcing positive thoughts, by reinforcing positive language, and then ultimately. Because of the relation between thoughts and beliefs being the things that you believe deep down, which can be kind of informed by the thoughts you have, if you know, and the way you act, because you then, like you said, if you're having all these negative thoughts, you say you'll never amount to anything, and you don't do anything because you don't believe that you can do anything or that you will amount to anything, so you think there's no point, it kind of confirms itself. So you come to believe that. And once that is your belief, not just something you've said, it informs the way you act, you know, and more like you said before, chicken and egg, which comes first? Is it the belief or is it the language? It is hard to know, you know, maybe it's the belief that comes first actually. And maybe in certain situations that belief gets brought to the surface and becomes much bigger than it ought to be. But that's something, I guess, well, this research would suggest that those people, part of their predisposition is the fact that they have absolutist thinking styles.
So one thing we can agree on is that the path to get better is to identify these cognitive distortions, of which absolute thinking is one of them, and to challenge them, right?
100%, 100%, 100%.
Put them in the right context, and act in a way that actually empowers you in the world.
Yeah, exactly. Let's work through a bit now. The never amount to anything is actually, I've realized, a double absolutist statement, right? So never is an absolutist word. So in all of time, from now until when you die, that is never, right? Essentially. And then anything I mean, there's two problems with anything, actually. And this is it makes it even worse. So it's probably a triple, if you want to call it that, if we can score it in a way. Anything is, you know, everything that exists, basically anything that you can identify. But so it has that all encompassing, you know, expansive property to it, really, really big, you know, so big that it's inconceivable. Right. And coupled with never, it's like, well, I'll never be anything. So I'm basically nothing. But the problem with it, how do you define anything? What is anything? You know, for some people, anything might be, you know, some people might be very, very perfectionistic, and they might be very high achieving. But for them, I'll never amount to anything means I'll never win a Nobel Prize. And how many people win a Nobel Prize? I mean, you're definitely not going to win one when you're thinking like that. But the second thing is, if you don't win a Nobel Prize, you're not, you know, in your mind, your belief is that you're nothing. You know, so it doesn't just strike people who are obviously down and out and, you know, who are homeless and living on the street. It can strike anyone, because your frame of reference for anything, you know, for someone significant is, you know, what is it? You know, that's so in analyzing a thought like that, you know, you have to deconstruct it word by word. So, you know, like you were saying, Henry, we take never and we'd say, what would we say with never?
Is that true across all all time scales? Can you really read the future?
And exactly. And what would someone say to that? I mean, that sounds ridiculous. Of course you can't. And with anything, I mean, we're not omniscient. We don't know everything. We don't know everything that exists. And you approach someone and tell them that if they present a thought, one of their own thoughts like this, and you say, whoa, you telling me that you know everything, that you know of everything? And they would say, of course not. I mean, they definitely would, if they've got a really negative view of themselves, they definitely would say they don't. But it kind of, that would kind of exaggerate the absurdity of the statement, right?
Yeah, definitely. So let's take, for example, the Nobel Prize person that you mentioned. So they'll never amount to anything. And then when we dig deeper, the motivation behind that is that they think it's too difficult to become a Nobel Prize winner. That they won't be the one to be that. And therefore, they will not have amounted to anything. And therefore, will be nothing. In whose eyes is that? We could start postulating, and maybe we'll ask that person, okay, where did that expectation come from? Perhaps it came from a very over-demanding family, right?
Exactly.
And maybe they put a lot of pressure on what you should achieve. And perhaps it became conflated in that poor person's mind that their only worth comes through some sort of arbitrary achievement. And then we have to question that, right? Is your self-worth something that's trivial? And, well, I don't want to trivialize somebody's goal, but you know what I mean, right? Surely that's not your only place of self-worth, right? There's something much more to you than just some arbitrary goal.
100%. And that is what everyone, I think this goes far beyond absolute thinking of itself. You know, this kind of bleeds into, this bleeds into self-worth. You know, this bleeds into the idea that each of us, it has an innate worth, that it is not simply, we are not simply defined by our achievements. You know, that we are worthwhile. And our achievements are good and useful and make us feel fulfilled, but without them, we are not nothing. You know, we have an innate value. And like you've said many a time, this is probably a Judeo-Christian idea, you know, that human life, human beings have value, and whether or not people in our society recognize that to be the case, probably they would agree that, you know, human child, you know, has value. You know, infanticide is wrong. Genocide is wrong. You know, most people would agree with that, even if they don't admit, openly say, I'm a Christian, or I'm Jewish, or I'm Muslim, or whatever it might be. Right. Mm-hmm. So that's interesting. And of course, it bleeds into that argument, that discussion. But coming back to the discussion at hand, so we've got this statement now and we've challenged it, but what would be a better thought to supplant that negative thought with? Like, never amount to anything. What would be a better thought that we could supplant that thought with?
Yeah, it's not enough to just take things away. We have to replace it with something that's
exactly
useful that, and empowering. So
a new script that we can rehearse, right? A new
exactly.
one.
A new strategy of your place in the world and how to act in it. Let's see. It would be something along the lines of, if I put my time and energy into something, then I will achieve.
I think that's good. I think it's good, but I may even go as far as to say that I would make it even less contingent on the achieving. Because I would say that if you don't achieve, then you think, oh, well, I can't, you know, because there's this idea that if I put my time and effort into something, I could achieve. I could at least have an opportunity of achieving. Whereas, I guess it might be better to look at it alternatively from the I will achieve, in the sense that, you know, that's like a very motivated thing to say, you know, it's a good visualization, right? I guess my point is probably less of a positive visualization, in the sense that you accept that there's a possibility that you may achieve and you have to work for that fact, but it may not necessarily happen.
Yeah, that's true. And it's also, the question is also, which kind of achievement are we talking about? If it's a personal achievement in terms of I will have moved on from my previous state, right? From my previous low, let's just say, competence in this field, I will have achieved a greater competence in that field.
Exactly.
Whereas if it's an arbitrary competence, like I have to be number one or any number, whatever it might be.
Or Nobel Prize,
right? Then that's very specific. And if you can deal with that, then that's great. But right now, I guess we're more moving towards the general concept of how to be
better.
How to be better and how to view yourself and your problems.
So I think, there are different kind of thoughts on this, but some people would probably say that the kind of, at least at this level, like you said, if you can deal with it, then you can accept it, and you can deal with not being number one or not having that Nobel Prize. Sorry to keep using that as the example, but this what I chose. You could say some things about me, maybe. When it comes to getting out of that low state, attacking that and supply that negative thought, I guess what's better than nothing? It's right. It actively trying and be better than the yes, do that. And even then, just have to try, you know, because if you try, you'll be marginally better than the person you were yesterday. Or at least you'll be marginally better than the person that you could have been if you didn't try. So to view that in that way is very positive, because it feels like you're adding to your stack. It doesn't feel like you're just instantly from your goal. If you see what I mean, you're adding, you know, day by day to your stack, and that's a much more positive way to look at your journey than to see 100 because one, I guess, if to someone like a marathon runner, the way they have to deal with the difficulty of running a marathon, especially at the speeds they do, at some point it's probably, they say, well, it's just one foot after another, you know, it's one step after another. And you can view those steps as, you know, if you think any achievement is like a marathon, it's a long-term goals. They're made up of these little steps. And so each day, step, or each hour in each day, or however you want to look at it, is a is a little step, and focusing on those steps and achieving those steps, and at least trying to get to your, is probably a goal than saying, well, I'm still, you know, the goal is to Nobel Prize, and it's so far away. Mm. And although I can appreciate now that if I try, I could get there. It's one of those very, very distant goals that might at the beginning be a little bit heartening, and it may be easier, at least from a motivational point of view, to start with something that's closer to you. Mm. While your ultimate goal is still to get there, you appreciate that it's important that you try your best, and that's the most important thing. You know, that you do the best that you can do, because no one can argue with that. You can't even argue with that yourself, because, you know, you've tried your best and you've done everything you can do, and life has panned out that way. It's almost like you accept that there is some level of fate. There is some level of, I don't want to say determinism. I want to say something else. There is some level of things that you can't control in the universe, you know, such as the outcome of all things. They don't always go your way. So the best you can do is to try your best against that inevitability, and maybe it will, maybe it won't. But there you go. So I think what would be our final sentence, Henry, you think, given all that psychobabble?
I think a good summary would be that there are many things in this world that we can't control. But what we can control is our mindset and our actions in the face of that.
Mm. Very good. And so if I try my best, I can get better and I can get closer to my goal. And while I may not reach that, you know, very, very lofty goal, I will be better than I am today.
Yeah.
And it sounds...
And it's an idiom that goes like...
Serenity.
Say that again?
Serenity prayer. Were you going to talk about the serenity prayer?
Ah. Oh, that's an even better one. So I'll quickly say the one that I thought of, and then you say that one. So the one I thought of was, if you aim for the stars, at least you might hit the moon, right? If you miss.
Exactly. Exactly. Like, because if that's a good point. And I think sometimes people can become awfully defeatist with this like lofty goal in front of them. And then, you know, they just don't reach it all because they're like, oh, it's too far. I'm not even going to aim for it.
Yeah.
Which I think we both love, has a good place in my heart. I'll only read the portion of it because it's the most relevant to what we're talking about right now. There is another portion, a second part to it. So it goes like this: serenity, I cannot change; courage to change the things I can; and the wisdom to know the difference. Now, there's a lot of we could probably keep coming back to this in many episodes to come, and you know, because at the end of the day, acceptance is in there. There's the courage to change the things I can. So you know, to realize that you know it does take everyone. It takes a bit of courage to get up and try to change things that are, you know, you don't like about yourself. Or that you don't like the way you're living, you can change them, and it does takes effort, and that takes courage, and the wisdom to know the difference. It's, you know, you have to realize that there sometimes you'll think that there's something that is under your control, and so you blame yourself for it, but it actually really isn't, and that takes, you know, that takes experience, and you know, developing the wisdom to know what is really your responsibility and what is not, what things you can change and what things you can't. And I think that's a really good a prayer to remind yourself that you know, we are the universe, that we are somewhat limited in the universe, and that there are certain things that we just have to accept and that won't go necessarily go our way. But yeah, so now we introduced Gattaca at the beginning, and now we've kind of thrown the meat at you guys of absolutist thinking and what it means, how to tackle those thoughts. So just a rough guide of how to tackle those thoughts, and we will give you some more resources that you can go away and use about challenging thoughts. But we will come back to this topic again and again, because you know, it's central, you know, to what we're interested in, you know, psychobabble, the language of psychology and how it informs our actions and our beliefs. But we introduced Gattaca
before. People with cognitive distortions, everybody has them in different
exactly
areas.
Exactly.
It's limiting exactly them in exactly ways, but important ways.
And the massive thing is that they don't know, and it's when you then introduce them to this concept, they're like, "Wow, I am limiting myself," and it's not magic or you know. I mean, it seems like magic afterwards, you know, and it makes you realize the power of language. And, but it's something that everyone can get on board with. And I think, like you said, everyone has, you know, to some extent in some areas of their thinking, in some areas of their lives. So yeah, we talked about Gattaca before, and you gave the synopsis. So how does this fit? How does it fit in then, like with the language and things? Like I mean, there are some good examples, aren't there, Henry?
I think it's a particularly good one because we have a world that has certain expectations of how people perform, and in this world we have one character that sort of sticks out and is different from the rest. The way he sticks out is that he's naturally born and has a standard set of genes that you're born into by chance through natural birth, whereas almost everyone else is born through genetic engineering and they've got the best that their parents can offer them in terms of genes given to them. And this world has developed in such a way that you are almost predestined to a certain kind of career and status through your genes.
So it's very, in for want of another term, it's very absolute. You know, your potential and your achievement in life is preset, and everything is absolute and it's very fixed. It is unchanging because all your potential is defined by your genes. And at least in this scenario, they can't be changed. And as in our own currently.
Mm-hmm. So what happens in a world where people are completely judged, their whole worth to society and to everyone else is judged by something that they can't change, your genes? Well, unfortunately, in this society, if you want to be, for example, an astronaut and you've got quote unquote bad genes, then you just won't be accepted. No matter how amazing an astronaut you would make, your genes will completely exclude you. Unfortunately for our hero, he wants to be an astronaut. He wants to leave this, let's just say, limited planet and its limited people with absolute thinking. He wants to live somewhere where he's free and not judged by something arbitrary like genes. So he does his best to try and infiltrate the astronaut academy and leave his planet by assuming somebody else's identity. And he fools all of these genetic checkups through very sort of skillful and ingenious ways to insert a fake pee sample or fake blood from his new identity, this other person who's essentially, let's just say, body he's borrowed. This person, he supports him. His name is Eugene. Our hero, his name is Vincent. And Vincent gets all sorts of biological matter from his donor given to him because they have built this system like a partnership where the work and money that Vincent does is used to support the lifestyle that Eugene would like to live.
Exactly, yeah.
So it's not like he's just got a corpse and is harvesting material off of it.
Yeah, it's freely given.
A living partnership. It's a symbiosis, I guess.
Exactly.
I think we can put the film in two categories, right? There's our hero who's really hopeful and he's trying to maintain his integrity and healthy thoughts in the face of all of society, which is throwing their absolutist thinking about his fate at him.
Mm. Yeah, he's kind of like the positive thought, isn't he? He's kind of like the warrior of the positive thought, the challenge. He's the challenge.
Yeah, exactly.
So you know, Vincent kind of comes as the challenge to negative absolutist thoughts.
Yeah, he's got hope. He's got courage. He's got wisdom. He's got faith in this idea that he's just so much more than his genetics. This arbitrary
exactly.
That they want to measure him with. And
that he can be so much more as well.
He can be so much more. And then contrasted to him is one character that I think we could really focus on. I think he's a great case study for absolutist thinking. It's his friend and I suppose his symbiotic partner in this dual identity that he tries to assume to get past the discrimination, right? So that he can be an astronaut, is his friend Eugene, who... It's quite funny, right? Because of the name Eugene, you means good, and Gene, we could say, is he's got good genes or a good body.
Of course.
Yeah. But Eugene, unfortunately for him, has some very absolutist thinking, and he's like the polar opposite of our hero, Vincent. And it takes him down very dark places.
Definitely. I mean, we'll discuss. I mean, his demise at the end of the film is self-inflicted.
Oh, man.
So, yeah.
Poor Eugene. Should we do a little synopsis of Eugene?
Yeah. I mean, do you want to do it or shall I do it?
You do it, bro.
I think. Okay, fine, cool. So, Eugene, which is actually his middle name. His full name is Jerome Eugene Morrow. This is the identity that Vincent takes over in order to import academy because that's his dream his whole life. But Eugene, as we're kind of speaking about him, he was a swimming champion when he was a bit younger. And he essentially didn't win gold at a swimming meet or an Olympic. It doesn't specifically say in the film, but he didn't win gold. And in his mind, as someone who was born to genetic excellence, who was supposed to achieve, you know, who should always achieve, he can't accept it. You know, and there's a line in the film where he says he's brandishing his silver medal and he says, Jerome Morrow, you know, that's Eugene. I mean, that he's not using his middle name there, but he says, Jerome Morrow was never meant to be one step down on the podium. With all I had going for me, I was still second best. Now, if we deconstruct that, he says Jerome Morrow was never meant to be one step down on the podium. And what that does, it creates for him this, you know, his genetic profile, this genetic superiority has created this impossible standard to live up to the point where if he doesn't achieve number one on his first try, that means that it's over. Time, like, it's done. You know, there's no concept of getting better and improving with effort and training hard to get better. That's the end, right? You know, and so there's this idea of failure there. Even with all I had going for me, I was still second best. You know, he's a loser. You know, he was given all the right cards and he still lost. You know, and it's very final, it's very finite, very absolute, right? That whole idea. So then what he does, you don't see it as part of the film, you know, but it's part of his backstory. is he wants to kill himself. So he walks out in front of a car in an attempt to do so. And we know this because in the film he's quoted as speaking to Vincent, and he's drunk. And he says, "I wasn't drunk." And Vincent asks him what he means. And he said, "When I walked in front of that car, you know, I'd never been more sober in my life." And then Vincent's telling him to ignore it, to go to sleep. And he says, "I couldn't even get that right." And then he worryingly says, "If at first you don't succeed, try again." So it gives you a good insight into Eugene's, mindset, you know, despite all his genetic brilliance and all his gifts that he's been given at birth, he's got a very, very unhealthy absolutist mindset that is very, or as some people might say, fixed. You know, with other people you do use as growth and fixed, you know, mindset kind of dipole. So, and that's his story. He's essentially, at one point, Vincent says something that he bore the burden of perfection on his shoulders, you know, because anything less for him, anything less than perfection, because he'd always been treated like that by his family and everyone around him, would signify something wrong, you know, as rather than the normal process of coming to grips with something and getting better, right? The process of failure and then getting better and success after failure, through failure.
It's really interesting, right? The way he sees himself and his genes, it's like, is he truly the perfect human that he should always get gold no matter what happens, right? Is he truly the perfect specimen? Like, how does he know that, right? I mean, we can all agree that he has good genes. Yeah, really good genes. You know, amazing genes. But does that mean he's the perfect specimen all the time with no fail? That's just...
Exactly. It doesn't. Because what does it fail to do, right? It fails to take into account happenstance and possibilities outside of your genes don't dictate everything that happens to you. I mean, it's a funny kind of echo to the Serenity Prayer in the sense that, you know, like you have to know the difference between what you can control and what you can't. What your genes, or what I guess becomes you, control, and what you can't control. And there's a whole universe outside of your genes, right? And that's gonna affect your life, right? And it's gonna affect whether you win. You know, winning gold at a swimming meet, you're against someone else. Like, what if that kid has your genes, like just as good as you, so much longer? You know, like, how does that then suddenly make you invalid? It doesn't. It just means that you have to train harder.
Exactly. He decides instead that if he can't win the game by having gold consistently all the time with no fail, he'd rather just not play the game and quit life.
Exactly. Yeah.
Oh god.
Exactly. And that mindset, you know, that mindset definitely comes across, you know, with some people, and it's a very defeatist mindset. And no wonder, it's not surprising that people with that mindset then go on to develop depression if they haven't already got it, or rather people with the depression expressed one of those that, you know, that kind of behavior, that kind of language.
There's that last thing that Eugene said in your quote, if at first you don't succeed, try and try again. That's actually right attitude to have, right?
But it's so ironic, right?
Yeah, it's ironic, isn't it? Because he's perverting it, because he's talking about quitting the game again. I mean, life. He still doesn't get the quote properly, right? It's really sad. I mean, he's so close and yet so far.
Definitely. And there's also a great exchange. So there's another part of the film. So that's Eugene. Eugene is the incredibly negative, fixed mindset, lots of absolute thinking going on with him. And he eventually, at the end of the film, at the climax of the film, while Vincent is flying off into space, Eugene kills himself. You know, he burns himself in an incinerator. It's terrible. you know, because he still can't, he can't exist with that angst, you know, of just not being, not living up to this genetic burden that he has.
Yeah, an arbitrary burden that he, that society placed on him, and then that he decided to continue placing on himself.
And that's so important, isn't it? That's so important, because it's, I mean, how often does that happen in our world? You know, how often does, how often are, do people place things on you or I or anyone out there? And rather than challenge it, we continue, we perpetuate it in our minds. And this is where, this is why it's important to challenge those thoughts, because those thoughts probably, they probably came from when you grew up. Maybe it wasn't your parents. Maybe it was someone else. Maybe it was mean kids at school. Who knows? But the fact is, you're perpetuating it in your mind the more you rehearse it. There's also a fascinating relationship between Vincent and his brother. You know, do you want to go over that, Henry?
Yeah, gladly. So Vincent's brother, his name is Anton. He was born through genetic engineering, and he's the second son of this family. And when they had their first son, they decided to do it naturally. And then they realized just how much discrimination there was against him and how many health problems he had, that they thought, oh, never again. No, no, no. Our second son will definitely definitely be genetically engineered, right? See, the unfortunate thing for Vincent is that he was born with a high likelihood of developing some sort of heart problem, right? But that's just statistically speaking. And there's no way to know, right, until he actually has his heart problem, that he, that this is going to be the case. It's not a certainty, right? It may well be the chance, it may well be possible that he doesn't develop his heart problem. Vincent is going by faith in that, because there's no, I mean, why would you live your life as if you would die at 30?
It's not useful, is it? It's not
very
useful.
Exactly.
Just so as absolutist thinking is not useful.
Yeah, exactly. It's not to say that you should ignore it or something. Keep it in mind, but should your whole life be built around the idea that you're definitely going to die at 30 because of a heart disease, as his parents were wanting to sort of indoctrinate him with? Vincent was like, no, I'm not accepting that. There may well be a chance that I'm not that guy that dies of heart disease at 30. So I'm going to do my best and continue doing my best.
But even if he were, right, surely the way to live in the interim, I mean, if let's say we, and we all, I mean, it's funny, the funny part is we all know we're going to die someday, right? It's a question of time. And so if someone's going to die at 30, I guess the thing is, they're going to have a lot of their life between 30 and 60 or 70 that's cut short. Yes. But there's still a whole lot of living to do between birth and 30.
Yeah.
And so,
and you must do your best, right?
You have even more of an imperative to live your life positively and doing as much as you possibly can, because you have an even more of an imperative than other people may do, that can wait around for another 40 years to get going.
Right, and Anton is the best of his mother's genes and the best of his father's genes, and within a few years he's already outgrown Vincent. And poor Vincent is, despite being the older brother, living in the shadow of his younger brother. And sadly for him, it's his younger brother that receives a lot of the father's attention and being told to go and achieve and such, whereas Vincent is just told to be careful and being mollycoddled and, oh, you might hurt yourself, oh, your condition and whatever, which is... it's not very empowering, right? I mean, boys will be boys. You know, they're going to go out there and they want to try things. They want to be courageous. But then being told, oh, no, you know, your condition, you need to be careful and whatnot. I don't think that builds a very, let's just say, strong and exploring mindset, if you know what I mean. But Vincent, despite that, he's got this really strong spirit and he doesn't let that get to him. and he develops into a really strong individual in the future. Yeah. And there's this competition that he has with his brother that really well symbolizes the inevitable conflict that they have in their worldviews. See, because because Anton is always being told that he's able to succeed because of his genes, he unfortunately develops a limited mindset where his self-worth is placed in an arbitrary value that is his genes, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he thinks he's got a free pass for everything because of his genes. So they have this competition where they go out into the ocean and they swim and they swim and they swim as far as they can. And the first person to be afraid and desire to go back to the to the beach is the loser. He's the chicken, right? And to be honest, it's a stacked game, isn't it? The one with the superior body will be the one that has the greatest endurance and should theoretically be the one that chickens out last. And we see these brothers taking part in this competition between each other again and again and again. And Vincent loses, let's just say predictably, all the time. But what's interesting is the way Vincent narrates this struggle. He says something along the lines of, yeah, well, of course I lost. Anton, with his genes, had no excuse to lose. And this is a point in Vincent's life where he's still sort of struggling with this limited and absolutist thinking that his parents and society is throwing at him. So he's displaying the same thought behavior. So, of course, if we just deconstruct, of course, it's stating the result as if it was an inevitability.
Mm, as if there was no possibility any other way.
Yeah, that it's self-obvious, right?
Mm, mm.
And then that Anton had no excuse to lose.
Mm.
It is pretty much a similar way of saying the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
But then at one point, something changes. And do you want to go through that?
Yeah. You want me to go through it? Yeah. Well, so essentially, so then we skip to towards the end of the film, and to not go into it too much, Anton has found out that Vincent is, and Anton is a detective. He has found out that Vincent is misusing someone else's identity, and it tries to rat him out and take him to prison essentially for what he's done. And really what this is about is about, so one time, when they're both in their teens, before this showdown, Anton and Vincent have this swim off as they do this chicken, the game of chicken. And Vincent, kind of at that point in time has just, is kind of looking to join the Astronaut Academy and is full of this, you know, hope and sense of possibility. And they play this game of chicken, and Vincent for the very first time wins and swims further. And not only that, but Anton starts to drown and Vincent saves him. And Anton, after that point, until this showdown in the film, much later in both their lives, has kind of pushed it, you know, well, seemingly pushed it to the back of his mind, but really it's always been there. The time that he was beaten by his genetically inferior brother. Now he must be imperfect or he must be bad in some way, a failure in some way, you know, because if he can't succeed with those genes, just like Eugene, then, you know, there's something wrong with him and he's a failure. So they there's a showdown going on. And Anton wants to take Vincent down, and Vincent says, you know...
All right, so now we're in the future, right? So now time has moved on. The brothers have said they've never seen each other again.
So this is the showdown.
There's a second showdown because his brother is resentful for that.
Yeah, so this is the showdown in the office when Anton is a detective. Vincent, is getting accused of these crimes of having stolen someone's identity. Like I said, further in the future. And Anton essentially says, you didn't beat me that day. You know, going back to that day when they were in their teens and Vincent had beaten Anton. He says, you didn't beat me that day. I beat myself. Vincent then, he laughs. He said, who are you trying to convince? You're trying to convince yourself. And Anton says, do you want me to prove it to you? I'll prove it to you in this way that says, well, he's not really trying to prove it to Vincent. He does want to prove it to himself that he can beat him because it's so important to his worldview that he is someone genetically superior, is superior in outcome, in ability, despite the fact that he might not have been training as hard as Vincent and not have the mindset to go as far as Vincent will. He should, because of his fixed genes at birth. And so they go and they go out to the ocean and they're swimming and they get out really far. And the first person to question anything is Anton. And he says, where's the shore? You know, and then Vincent says, oh, you want to quit? And Anton starts complaining that they're too far out and says, exclaims, how are you doing any of this? We have to go back. And Vincent then basically explains that he did all any of this because he never held anything back. You know, he gave everything his all. And that's the crucial part, is that it's not about what you're given, what you start with. It's about how much you give it, how much you try. And if you're, have this kind of fixed absolutist mindset where nothing is going to change, that's all you ever will be and that's all you have, and you'll never amount to anything, to use our phrase from earlier, never amount to anything more than you already are, then of course you're not going to go very far. Of course you're not going to get any further. Whereas if you're like Vincent, and you believe that you can get further than where you are, and you can, as long as you try, and as long as you try as hard as you possibly can, then you can get somewhere. Then of course you can overcome those boundaries. Who knows what you can actually do in the end?
And so that's, there's no gene for the human spirit, and there's no gene for fate.
Exactly. Because what's going to push you past that point where your body is telling you to stop? It's purely your will, right? And the argument, I guess, in this film, well, we still don't know. What is human will? We don't know. It's a very complex principle. And where does it come from within our consciousness? We don't know. We barely know anything about consciousness, to be honest. And that is why this film is so perfect for this topic, because it not only verbally, displays absolutist thinking and the antidote to it, but in the actions of the characters, it paints the portrait of the absolutist and the non-absolutist mindset, and how
the impact that it has on your lifestyle and the way exactly you treat other people
and the path of your life ultimately. And one thing that I don't know if we've spoken about before, we probably have, is that my absolutist mindset, I mean, this is probably my takeaway for the day or for the week or from this podcast, is that, heart failure may come to us at some point in our lives, diabetes or, sedentary lifestyle. There are any number of physical medical health conditions that can, trouble us in life. And will hold us back in obvious physical ways, potentially. But the absolutist mindset, if left unchecked, is so insidious, it can dictate the whole course of your life. And this is something that this film shows very well. And I think it's something that every person out there listening to this podcast needs to think about. You know, how has your own absolutist thinking impacted the course of your life? And how is it still impacting the course of your life? And so for me, having a lot of contact with people every day in my job, seeing it as a real effect on people's lives, you know, absolutist thinking and other distortions as well, but absolutist thinking can have a huge impact on the course of your life and can be more insidious and more damaging than any physical health problem, I find, and have a greater impact because it influences everything you do.
Hmm. Yeah, because let's just say you smoke, right? Then at some point, the associated problems like lung cancer and whatnot, maybe they'll hit you around 60. Is that on average? Let's just say.
Yeah. I mean, if you've been smoking since the age of 20, let's say, and you've been smoking solidly a pack a day for about 40 years, 60 is not a bad shout. If not lung cancer, then at least some kind of lung disease, you know, like inflammatory lung disease, which can cause you many, many other problems.
Mm-hmm. But with an absolutist mindset, you could be cutting off an amazing job opportunity or this degree that you always wanted to study or this person that you wanted to ask out. It's impacting all decisions in your life, cutting off all of these hopeful and bright futures completely.
Mm. Every day. I mean, you could look at it, yeah, aborting is a good word. You could look at it as you're killing potential yous every single day and potentially great versions of yourself every day. You know, so how many lifetimes or years of your life have you cut off? Like potentially great, enjoyable, fulfilling years of your life have you just, you know, wiped off because of your absolutist mindset saying you'll never be able to do this. You always fail and holding yourself back from attempting things and future success.
Yeah. That's really well said. I haven't got much more to add to that, except this one little quote from Yoda, only the Sith deal in absolutes.
Brilliant. Well, guys, I hope you've enjoyed that. We don't want to go on for any much longer than that. But we're going to add a few resources in the box below. Leave comments, tell us what you think, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you for your time.